Saturday night. Welcome to the people who have come from far and distant places like the Bay Area. It's nice to see some faces from haven't seen for a few months. And maybe some new faces. But motoring through our winter retreat. Having just passed Valentine's Day, thought a few words on loving kindness might be useful to differentiate it from Valentine's Day sentiments a little bit. But we've also, a lot of the themes around practice and in discussions, check-ins with people, have often returned and hovered around the theme of asubha practice this year. There's been a fair amount of discussion with that, contemplation of the body, contemplation of the 32 parts of the body, asubha practice, and very important mind training and very useful practice for many different reasons. And we've also discussed some of the teachings around balancing that. We've mentioned the Meghya Sutta a couple of times where the Buddha talks about developing, at least to help stabilize the mind with several essential tools of practice, several contemplations, and four that he points out with specificity are the asubha practice, the practice of metta bhavana, development of loving kindness or goodwill, and the development of contemplation of impermanence, anicca, sanya, the perception of impermanence, and actually prior to that, anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. Those four are sort of four tools that everybody should have in their meditation toolkit. So I've been thinking to mention a few words about metta, translated often as loving kindness, perhaps a little bit more appropriately in some of our minds as goodwill, the development of goodwill. Both asubha and metta are used as oftentimes reflected on as specific antidotes to obstructive mind states, asubha for sensual craving and metta for as an antidote for ill will or aversion. But both of them, in and of themselves, and in a sense particularly metta, are worthy contemplations to develop in and of themselves, just with that, you know, without necessarily having to be an antidote to anything, just very, very, particularly thinking about metta, very beautiful, sublime mind states, regardless of whether there's a strong presence of ill will or not. And sometimes if we just concentrate too much on development of, say, some of the practices that are specifically geared towards abandoning negative mental states or states like sensual craving, then if there's kind of the wrong kind of striving or excessive striving, the mind can become if it's picked up too vigorously or without wisdom, the mind can become quite tight or constricted. And we need to make sure that we balance that, those kinds of strong practices with practices that open the mind, open the heart, and allow for spaciousness and very positive states of mind. It's not that the Asubha practices don't result in positive states of mind. When the fevers are cooled, that's very positive. But if picked up unwisely, can result in tightness, constriction. So we need to have other tools at hand as well. Both of them, all of them, have to be within the presence of a strong development of sati sampajanya, mindfulness and clear awareness, so that we have this ability to pull ourselves into this moment to know clearly what state of mind we are practicing with and the results of the practices that we do pick up, so that we see clearly the effect that these different contemplations are having, and to adjust as we need to adjust to keep the balance. So very important to have that sensitivity, present moment, calling ourselves into the moment with an inquisitive mind that says, okay, what is really the state? What's happening now? How would it be useful for me to direct my attention? So metta, all of these Brahmaviharas have their descriptions and some comparisons that come more in the commentaries, but a useful one that I find is looking at what the near enemies are. Sometimes we can get confused with what actually something like metta is all about. And need to differentiate that quality of goodwill that the Buddha talks about developing as a Brahmavihara, making sure that we're not confusing it with states of affection, states of what we would normally call love, that lead to attachment. Because as we all know, is attachment, clinging, is the root, one of the root causes of suffering, holding tightly to an object of desire. When that changes, we all know there's pain involved, dukkha involved. So being careful not to confuse metta, either conceptually or actually at a very deep practice level, not to confuse it with attachment. And that takes that presence of sati sampajanya and discernment, wisdom, to be able to ferret that out. When is loving kindness morphing into sensual desire at one extreme, or more subtly into say emotional attachment? So it's good to keep that in mind and to look at the relationships we have in the world and see how we are holding them. Romantic love is a biggie, of course. People who haven't committed themselves to a monastic life or a celibate life generally will seek an experience in the world of finding a partner. And certainly that is a very skillful way to live in relationship in the world for non-Buddhists. For for people who aren't practicing celibacy, having a stable relationship rather than being always on the search or having multiple relationships, things like that, can lead to more stability in one's life. And if it's a healthy relationship, and I think there are some of them out there, not all, but some healthy relationships that can be stabilizing, nurturing, and helping people keep a balance in their lives. And it's also interesting to kind of watch that energy, to watch when you're not in a, if a person's not in a relationship, to watch and see the strength of the pull towards that kind of what we would call romantic love. It's a very potent energy that can involve and involve a lot of time and energy in establishing. It's a very strong force of becoming, that seeking out of a relationship. And that level of intensity during the search for not only a sensual or sexual relationship, but also one that's helping to ground the emotional base, can be quite consuming. And to notice that if one is in that particular mode of entering into a relationship or seeking to enter a relationship, and just to notice the intensity of that movement of mind that can happen, and then when a potential relationship is there, the all-consuming nature in those initial stages. It's interesting to watch sometimes from the point of view of living in a monastic community, the world around us and the people that come and go, and oftentimes people who are associated with the community in Dhamma practice or just Dhamma practitioners out in the world, if they leave a relationship or if a relationship ends, then we tend to see them a whole lot more in the monastery, oftentimes becoming quite regular attendees and supporters. And then when another relationship starts to happen, where did they go? And can often disappear for weeks and months and years at a time because of the nature of forming a new relationship tends to be very intense and very consuming, and oftentimes romantic love wins over Dhamma. Mm-hmm. So it's just not that that's a bad thing in any way in terms of seeking out that kind of stability, eventual stability in one's relationships. But just noticing the intensity of the amount of time and energy and commitment it takes to enter into that. And then, that kind of love or affection in a relationship, if it's nurtured in the right way and grown with wisely, can then oftentimes move into a more mature kind of relationship with another being if it's a committed one, and can kind of settle into something that's not quite so intense or agitating or involving. And settle into a more higher level of ease and genuine support. The emotional bonds are often still strengthening, and if one isn't much of a Dhamma practitioner or if isn't cognizant of these, the level of attachment can increase in a different way. in towards that long-term commitment with one other being, or possibly expanding to a family unit, with a certain intensity of emotional dependence. If not seen clearly or wisely, then one, even if it's a useful, and it can be a very useful, healthy mirror in that kind of relationship, that kind of partnership. People can be excellent mirrors for each other and learn quite a bit about themselves and each other, and their skills develop in that way, relationship skills, for some very fruitful development of the heart. If it is dependent on one other being for that kind of level of support and development, then it tends to be one that is going to result in some sort of difficulty or pain when that changes, when that stability changes. And to just bring that into conscious awareness, that someday that relationship is going to change, whether it's through growing apart and separation, people moving in different directions, or if not that, then through eventually old age and death will bring a separation to all of those kinds of relationships. So to use that as a contemplative tool to help reduce the clinging, the grasping that we can enter into. It can be particularly in these kinds of relationships, and it doesn't have to be just like partners, like people who are in partnership with each other, but also other layers of familial relationships, parents, children, brothers and sisters. There's certain levels of emotional attachment, bonding that occurs with those. And when those inevitably start to change or dissolve, there is that sense of grief, separation from the love, disdukkha. We chant it most every morning, separation from the light, separation from the love, disdukkha. And how to work with that to develop our understanding of how we can be released from that that kind of dukkha as well. That time when somebody is starting to pass away, whether it's a parent or a sibling or maybe a partner, or in some circumstances people lose their children, if it's done with awareness and with willingness to learn from it, then it can be a very fruitful experience to see very clearly the differences, say, between attachment and pure love. I had a very fortunate experience of spending a relatively fair amount of time, particularly towards the end of my mother's life. A couple of years ago, she passed away at the age of 92, almost 92. And over a number of years of gradual decline. Both myself and my sister and her family, she was more the primary caregiver, even though my mother never lived in their house. My sister was sort of the close attendee on hand to help managing, but I was able to spend some time also going back and visiting. And over that last bit of time in particular, I think all of us, through conscious reflection, and talking and even meditation, we're able to maybe readjust some of how we experience that relationship with her in her waning years. And by the time it came for her to escape her very painful aging body and move on, by that time, I think, you know, we had been able to work through and let go some of the more gnarly attachments that can occur in a parent-child relationship, and experience a level of peace and contentment with her passing that I've never experienced before at that level of intensity and beauty. And oftentimes people, during that last bit of a process or soon afterwards, would say, well, you know, are you grieving? Do you feel sad? Was it a hard experience? And it wasn't without emotion, but my experience was one of no, it wasn't. It wasn't difficult. It wasn't sad on an emotional basis. It was very moving. It was very poignant. But the sense was actually, particularly in the last day, she was taking her last breaths, and we were all gathered around, my sister, myself, and my two nephews and their partners were all there. And just the incredible level of peace as she took her last breaths and then stopped. And we had prepared ourselves for it and talked about, not to let ourselves get too exuberantly overwhelmed with emotion in her presence while she was passing, that could be very agitating for her, and to maybe, you know, not get into touching the body too much, that could be distracting for her as she's making her plans to leave. But just to try and be there peacefully, reassuringly with her, and let her know that we were there, but not to be engaging in any kind of overt clinging or emotion, and then just to be quiet. And it was one of the most profound experiences I think that all of us have had, and to share that. And when she took her last breath, there was just this incredible open metta and peace that accompanied that. And we all felt so fortunate to be able to experience that. And to me, that was just like a real clear example of goodwill and loving kindness without attachment. There was no sense of this shouldn't be, this is a loss, this is the wrong thing. There was no sense of that. You know, some people might think, oh, well, there's some denial or repression there, but it never felt like that. It still doesn't. So I think the potential is there if one wants to develop that kind of mental state in regards to even people you're very, very close to. And a period of transition, dying, is a prime opportunity to really look at that and make that differentiation between attachment and goodwill, kindness, love. Loving kindness without that kind of stickiness. Interestingly, a couple of years ago at one of the elders meetings we had in England, a topic came up of monastics and their role in caring for relatives. And it was a fruitful discussion. And I was able to at least relate some of my experience and how involved to get was kind of the theme, how involved to get with that process, because, you know, as the Buddha talks about, we all have a great debt to our parents for providing us with all the supports and bringing us up and caring for us for many, many years. And so that the debt of gratitude is very high, and the wish to repay that. So where does that come? How does that come about for monastics? And there's a whole wide range of experience, of course. Occasionally, even some monastics having to provide a substantial amount of support for aging and dying parents. But basically, even those people who had done that level of caring have were quick to point out that that's not necessarily the ideal for a samana, for one gone forth from the household life into homelessness, into the monastic training, and that those kinds of familial connections, the Buddha recommended really not severing, but in any way whatsoever, but really pulling back from direct day-to-day involvement to really devote oneself and one's energy to this pursuit of liberation, that it took a withdrawal from that kind of deep social familial connection. Not that it's eliminated, but that it's it's not part of the daily routine as it is a householder. So it's a tricky line, where does one support and honor those relationships and make sure that needs are met and people are cared for, versus getting overly enmeshed with those kinds of situations. So, and what I'm talking now is really geared towards the monastics here, not towards the lay community who have a different set of responsibilities, but just for the monastic community to keep that into consideration. And Buddha even talks about it in his simile of gold, refining gold, where little by little, using the simile of washing out the impurities of rocks and stones, grit from that's entwined and meshed with the gold in order to try and purify, to get down to the pure gold, going through several stages of refinement, of washing out these things, and starting with the gross impurities of, unskillful actions in body and speech, through use of precepts, and then moving more towards eliminating the stronger, grosser tendencies, obstructions of the mind, like ill will and harmfulness or cruelty and craving. Working to eliminate those. And then after those are eliminated, and you're moving down to what he calls the fine grit of the mind, looking at how attachment to clan, to the village, families, one's upbringing, is one of those, that level of attachment, to the extent that it's there, is an impurity, essentially, to be removed. Particularly aiming, I think, in this case, again, at the monastics, but still using the simile of, or the description of attachment, whether you're lay or monastic, I think is useful. And washing that away, that fine grit, until one is left with thoughts of Dhamma, which then can even be used and let go of to get down to more of a purity of mind. But that attachment to family, attachment to those old structures is something that a samana needs to pay attention to in refining the mind, letting go. So to be able to do that skillfully, not neglecting one's duties, but to notice and be aware of that more refined kind of mental attachment. I was fortunate enough to be able to kind of negotiate that line by providing a fair amount of assistance to my sister from a distance while still living in the monastery. So being able to do a lot of helping and organizing over the internet, and, you know, I actually ended up managing quite a bit of her finances and even purchasing medications from online pharmacies and getting them sent, so I was able to help a lot but still be present in the monastery. So with some diligence, maybe there are ways that monastics can be involved without having to commit oneself to being on site and getting lost in those kinds of activities and neglecting one's duties as a monastic and developing the monastic life and training. So it was a rich topic of discussion that time, and I think gave a lot of food for thought. But then developing the more refined or more pure state of how we can show goodwill, how we can develop goodwill, that's maybe not quite so specific to a particular being or a small group of beings. And that's the advantage, I think, of you know, people often say, well, you know, to monastics, don't you, you know, miss the intimacy or the quality of caring and love that one can find in a relationship? Isn't that, don't you find things kind of dry or emotionless or, you know, yeah, kind of sterile without those kinds of relationships? And, you know, what I experience and what I think many experience is that actually being free of that attachment to one being or a couple of beings, a few beings in, you know, very intense emotional relationships, being free of that allows me and others, I think, to experience a much broader state of loving kindness that's applicable and expandable to all beings. So the more we don't have to steer all of our energies into cultivating and nurturing very intense close relationships with one or two people, the more we're free to allow that caring, concern, kindness, gentleness to be inclusive to more people. And as we cultivate true metta, true goodwill, then it can become all-encompassing, non-exclusive. And that can be done in the lay community as well, the lay world, even in the household life, if one brings that into conscious awareness. And it's developed in that way to lessen the actual attachment while still maintaining the sense of caring and goodwill to the people that we are around. So it's getting all the benefits of that state of mind and releasing it from the constrictions that sometimes come along with it if it's not that pure kind of goodwill, if there's attachments involved with it, that to the extent that there is attachment and expectation and dependence on that particular kind of love, that's the extent to which it is limited. So there's lots of different techniques that people have heard and practiced, probably, oftentimes based on some of the commentarial ways of developing it, with the recitations and the reflections, gradually sending out metta to broader and broader groups, from oneself to those who are close and dear, to neutral people to people who we have struggles with, and then broadening to all beings eventually in different ways that that's developed and taught, using verbal recitation as a cue. And that's, I'm sure many people have experienced great benefit from that. I think some of us, and sometimes myself, can find that a bit formulaic at times, or a bit dry if it just becomes the words. Sometimes it can become that. So we experiment with different ways to make it real and to make it tangible and to bring it in. Because the purpose is to actually develop this, what we would call the metonymata, the actual experience of loving kindness, not just conceptual thoughts of what it is or words that represent it, but to actually experience the feeling of it and to develop that. And to allow it to naturally grow absorb into. It can become a full absorption when developed to its fullness, the full development of the Brahma-viharas are called boundless states, limitless states of mind. And what I find nurturing for myself in that development is actually holding maybe a slightly different approach, where the feeling, the sign of it is established through usually some sort of an initial recollection. Sometimes it's words in the traditional way, and oftentimes more it's a visual image of someone who's been kind, supportive, and that I have an immense amount of gratitude for the care and attention that was given to me in a difficult circumstance. Or in a situation like I was describing with my mother's passing, just bringing that image of that several-hour period as she took her last breath, and the peace and calm and expansive sense of kindness and love that came with that, just bringing that up as a memory, as a perception. Something to establish that sense of loving peacefulness or goodwill peacefulness that is very soothing and settling, and something that feels like you want to just settle into and be with and absorb into. Establishing that very firmly, however, what object you take up to establish that. And then staying there with it, staying right in the center of that sphere of goodwill, that peacefulness. And rather than starting to send it out in all the directions or to individuals and groups, rather than sending it out, there was one Thai meditation teacher who taught, and I found it very useful, to just stay with it and keep it in your own center of awareness, very, very firmly grounded in satisampajanya, mindfulness, and even grounded within the body, but with that very strong metta-nimitta, that metta-feeling of warmth or gentleness or kindness, expansiveness, and allowing inviting in a sense, various different images of people who are close, people your teachers, people your parents or fellow monastics, gradually inviting them into that space, but without leaving that particular center. And allowing gradually that conscious experience to expand, to become larger, larger and larger, but still maintaining that very firmly grounded presence right here in this body, but with a very strong presence of goodwill, of metta, that then can be a space where you can invite other beings of whether they're people that are easy to be with, people difficult to be with, groups of beings that you don't even know, just to gradually expand the space to allow more and more and more to enter into that space and to be there. So I find that a very useful imagery for myself in development of metta bhavana, development of metta, rather than as a conceptual exercise that then one tries to radiate, move out from one and lose one's base. And then it becomes very present, something to absorb into, and but not to lose one's balance. So this is a space of mind, a space of heart that can be taken to even what can be called at least a temporary liberation, the citta vimutti, liberation of the mind, or the release of awareness based on loving kindness if it's developed to its fullness, acting as a very firm grounding for further development of the practice. And it's also just a really nice place to hang out for a while. So, and it's from that kind of kindness too that I think that we can be our most effective in relationship to the world if we can develop that kind of relationship with other beings, then that's a space in which we can really offer support and help to others, to each other, from that sphere, rather than one that is based on expectation of return for something, or a kind of attachment that is dependent on a certain set of causes and conditions of presence of one or a few other beings. Because if we develop the broad, unattached form of goodwill, then doesn't matter who's in our lives. We don't have to have a particular set of beings around us. This kind of love is universal and transferable. It's not dependent on these specific, particular, narrow causes and conditions. So really encouraging people to develop this, however it works, whatever technique works, but to bring it into consciousness now, it's a we really have to nurture these expansive and positive states of mind as part of the development, as part of our right effort to developing wholesome states of mind that are supportive conditions for our practice. If we get too narrow or too fixed or too tight or too rigid or demanding and really trying to kill the defilements, kill the negative states of mind, it can become kind of a, not very pleasant state of being. We can get pretty tight and we start to look for relaxation and pleasure in less skillful ways. So really allowing this kind of open, beautiful states of mind based on goodwill, on compassion, joy, equanimity, really nurturing those, giving time to developing and absorbing, if possible, into these very, very beautiful and liberating states of mind. So I'll leave that there for a Saturday night reflection.